We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. This is episode 23, Secrets of Dumbledore, Outtakes and Conversations. Thanks for joining us at Potterversity. Emily Strand and I have talked with several of our normal podcast crew about our impressions of the Secrets of Dumbledore movie. These were impromptu conversations where we were still recording, but we were finished with our actually kind of scripted part of our podcast. And we thought you listeners might be interested to hear some of our thoughts about that. So we thought we would cobble together some of those conversations with Bea Groves, Lana Whited, and Louise Freeman, and Emma Nicholson, and hear some of our uncensored, let your hair down, thoughts about the latest movie in the Fantastic Beasts film series. So once again, I'm Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2.
And I am Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions and cultural competency at Mount Carmel College and author of several Harry Potter essays.
So we have a series of outtakes, and we're going to just cobble together some of our favorite insights.
And just to warn you, listeners, we are going to be talking about spoilers for the new movie, Secrets of Dumbledore. So if you haven't seen the movie, go out and see it and then come back and listen.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, Katie, how many times have you managed to see the film so far?
Twice.
Okay, yeah. I'm still on my first. I haven't had a chance to make it back, and then our COVID numbers are rising, and it doesn't make me want to go out. But I've heard that the film is going to be available soon on HBO Max.
Right. And I think by the time this podcast is out, it will be available on HBO Max. And you were saying, too, you'd prefer to see it on the small screen.
Yeah, I would just prefer to see it on my couch. I mean, if I had a big screen in my family room, then I'd watch it on that. But I don't. But I just prefer to be on my couch where no one in my vicinity has COVID. That's kind of where I'm at with all this.
I see. Right. Yes. I really liked seeing it. The second time, I felt like I learned a lot more. And, you know, I definitely want to see it a third time, especially after we had the podcast with Bea. Where I felt like I understood a lot more.
Right. Yes, I did too.
So what did you all think of the movie? Louise, what did you think? Have you seen it more than once?
Just once so far. I went the first weekend it premiered with my family, and that's the only time I have seen it. Really enjoyed it. I liked that they tied up a few things, like particularly the ending with Jacob and Queenie finally getting married. That was, I was hoping that one of the love relationships would come to a nice tidy end in this particular movie.
As a romantic, I also was very glad to see, and particularly that romance. And I loved the scene where, you know, she's like, but I'm like ruined. And he's like, no. Jacob's just so sweet. And there's such a loving, genuinely loving relationship there. And I totally believed it from those two actors as well.
They had great chemistry. And I loved the Shakespearean ness of ending with a wedding, which was lovely. Emma, how about you? How many times have you seen it, or have you seen it at all?
I've only seen it the once. So I went as soon as it came out because I don't like spoilers. But, you know, COVID and the price of movie tickets and stuff, I'm like, once will do until it comes out on streaming, because I, like you, Emily, I'm hoping it comes out sooner rather than later here. And I'll be able to watch it from the safety and comfort of my own couch with the pause and the rewind buttons, which I
love the pause.
Yeah. What is that? What just happened?
Yeah.
Go back. I think I missed something.
Well, or like, I got to go to the bathroom, you know, or I got to go, you know, get something to eat, or, you know.
Yeah. The first time I watched it, I had to, you know, exit the theater for necessities. And I picked a moment I thought, well, nothing's really happening. And it was the whole moment where I guess Albus and Aberforth are talking about what happened that summer.
Oops.
When I saw it the second time,
Not critical at all.
Was that in the cafe that they're the restaurant that they're in?
In Aberforth's house above the
Hogshead. Yes. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
You know, and I thought, oh, this is a little downtime because it's a lot of action. I was like, I don't want to miss any action. And it's a lot of downtime. And when I got back, my friend said, you know, oh, it's just, you know, when Dumbledore was, you know, being very good friends with Grindelwald, Aberforth had a relationship with a girl. She got pregnant. But like, that's not the whole, the whole thing. So I guess I'm the only one who's seen the movie twice. And I will tell you, you will like it better the second time. Because the first time I was like, what did I just watch? What is this?
Every one of the movies that you get more out of it second time. I think that's part of what happens when you're not starting with a book first and looking for things in the book left out. We've got to go back and see what we missed the first time.
Well, and that's true of her books too. I mean, her books are designed for rereading, you know, and I think that's true of the movies as well. Emma, what about you?
Yeah, absolutely. I need a second watch and I need subtitles with it because, like Louise, I'm really interested in all the love themes in this, of good relationships, bad relationships, you know, Dumbledore coming out finally. But subtitles help me pick up those little nuances in the dialogue that otherwise I miss. So that's what I'm keen to do, is look at all those little phrasings, because it's sometimes in the tiniest snippets we get the most meaning, you know, particularly when it comes to the Wizarding World.
Yeah. And I was like, I didn't know where we were at almost any time in the movie. Where are we? Like the very first scene, you know, like, where is he? And then it's Dumbledore and Grindelwald. Where are they? Are they really in a place? Like, what is this? And then why are we in Berlin? What's happening? What is happening?
Yeah. I miss those as well. I could use not only subtitles, but also like the script directions, you know, like, where are we now?
Yeah, I guess the script comes out in July. Yes. Is that what we've heard?
Yes. I feel like, yes. Okay.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
Go ahead.
Did you guys like the movie? Like, what did you think in terms of, like, where does this fall in terms of how you viewed the series as a whole? Is this a favorite? Is this a less favorite?
Well, I really liked it. I thought it was. I definitely thought it was better than the second one in terms of just general coherence and bringing the story together rather than splintering off in different directions, which was, I think, an issue in the second one. I did think it's interesting that they seem to be setting it up so that if this one is the last one, it has an ending.
Yeah, I thought that too.
I mean, there's clearly other directions they can go. There's a whole Newt and Tina thing that they haven't resolved yet and everything like that. But I know the movie has not made the money that they had hoped it would make. And, you know, there's been talks about pulling the plug after three rather than continuing with the five. And I think it's quite clear that they are in a position where they could very well do that.
Yeah. Do you think they'll do that, Emma? Or do you think they'll try to make more?
Look, I think particularly the last few years is quite challenging for movies. But if you look at international box office and not just the US, it did quite good internationally. So I think they may persist on that basis and go for the five. They're making good money out of the franchise. Every time they put a movie out, they're, you know, obviously getting merch sales and
selling
Disney World.
Stuff Nifflers.
Yeah, Universal. Yeah. Yeah, precisely.
I'd buy one, so, absolutely.
You know, you get this resurgence of interest in the books and stuff, so I don't see them letting go of it without a fight, to be honest.
Okay.
And I did like it better than I liked Crimes of Grindelwald, although I still have a soft spot for the first one. But maybe that's to do with Mads Mikkelsen, and he put in a great performance there. And you know, I also think the way that they dealt with Jacob as well, they sort of brought him to a new level of maturity with his mm-hmm. character. So I really like how that all played out. And again, loving the love themes, both, you know, light and dark in that.
Mm-hmm. I thought, so yeah, I thought Mads Mikkelsen was a really good, made a really good Grindelwald. I liked him. I found him a more attractive character.
Yeah, somebody I talked
in
to
all
recently.
The ways.
Yeah, in all the ways, right. Somebody I talked to recently talked about, he made some reference to, actually it was Arthur Harrow, who's a listener of our show. So hi, Arthur.
Yes.
I can't remember what he said, something about they've gotten rid of the sort of clownish mm-hmm. Grindelwald, which I agree Johnny Depp, you know, did play that in sort of a carnivalesque sort of way.
Right.
And I'm okay with that being over.
Which you didn't notice as much in the first one because you had that counterbalance of Colin Farrell.
Yes.
Playing him undercover mm-hmm. and it sort of slipped through, but then it really got highlighted in the second movie. So I'm glad that, you know, to see the back of that, because I think he needs to be human to support that relationship between him and Dumbledore, because to be honest, Depp's portrayal of it wasn't someone I could ever see, you know, Jude Law's Dumbledore falling in love with.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I agree on that one. It's, I mean, particularly that scene at the end where he's sort of directing the orchestra and doing this kind of dance at the arena while getting people to join him. And yeah, it was just so bizarre. And yeah, mm-hmm. I'm not a Johnny Depp fan anyway. I mean, forget the whole personal life stuff. I've just never been, I can't think of any particular ones of his films previous to this that I've ever actually liked. Yeah, so I think the change to the new Grindelwald was a big improvement on this.
Okay,
it was the exact sort of thing I could not see when you see Johnny Depp doing his little orchestra directing thing, it's like, why on earth would Dumbledore think this was attractive?
What's the appeal here?
Yeah.
Yeah. And okay. So I have a question. It goes back to the first movie, which I loved. So although I had the same reaction, Louise, as you were saying, with all of them at the first, I was like, how come like all of a sudden there was an ostrich walking down the street? Like there were things that didn't sync up, right? So things, she doesn't connect scenes, or whoever's doing it doesn't connect the scenes together well enough for me in general, but especially on viewing it other times, I loved the wonder. I loved the creatures. I loved the characterizations. So I really, the first one's probably still my favorite, but there's this thing that I don't get about the first one. And I thought it would be resolved by now, but I'm not sure it has been. So I'm going to ask you all if you know what this is. At the end of that movie, when the Johnny Depp, right, appears, and we know now that it's Grindelwald instead of, is it Graves? Then he says something to Dumbledore like, are you ready to die just a little?
Did you die a little inside or something like that?
Did you die a little inside?
Or something like that.
Yeah. And I'm like, well, what's that?
Yeah,
is that just messing with his head? Or is that supposed to be thematic? I thought, does it relate to the blood troth? I don't get it. And I expected to have some connector that would explain that. What do you think? I see some head shaking though.
I think it was just supposed to be creepy.
Just creepy. You know, okay.
Content poor creepy.
Maybe it has to do with the whole Ariana thing. You know, that Dumbledore feels such guilt over people he loves. And maybe it's a carryover from that is, you know, to see death and destruction, particularly if it's in relationship to someone that he loves, very powerfully. Maybe that it's like, you're watching me do this stuff. You can't do anything about it. Did you die a little inside?
Mm-hmm. It's taunting.
But why say it to Newt?
Oh, does he say it to Newt? I can't even remember.
Yeah, I mean.
So I think he knows he's going to carry it back to Dumbledore. Yeah,
why say it to Newt? It was.
It's the messenger.
Kind of strange.
Nice, and it's just, yeah, that's sort of a. You don't really think of Dumbledore as having experienced love's keen sting in.
Well, yeah, I felt it was dismissive when I read it. Yeah. You know, but then when you know all this behind, right, it's actually quite compassionate. You know,
yeah.
He does know what that's like.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly.
No, poor Lavender. Nice.
Lav.
Yes, oh dear. She does sort of come good a little bit, doesn't she? I was noticing her fighting in the.
Battle of Hogwarts,
which
yeah. She dies.
She dies,
poor thing.
She doesn't die in the books.
Oh, doesn't she? I thought she did. Maybe
ooh,
not.
I don't think so.
I don't know.
To check that. But yeah, I don't.
It's well, that's a dangerous. I mean, I hate it that you can Google these things and then you'll immediately come up with the film
movies.
Answer.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true.
And it's like
you do have to sort through. I have to do that with these quotes all the time. I have to make sure I'm getting a quote from the book and not the
movie. I always
movie.
Wonder with that, you know, turning on the light one, is that actually in the book?
Yes.
Good. Because it always comes up. No, she doesn't die. Just checking it out. So Fenway Greyback attacks her and Hermione saves her. No shrieked Hermione was definitely blast from her wand. Fenway Greyback was thrown backwards from the feebly stirring body of Lavender Brown.
That's so much better.
I love the fact that Hermione saves her. It's really nice, isn't it? Like, yay!
Yeah, girl supporting girl.
Girl supporting, you know, we've had our differences over Ron, but this is all Ron's fault. And
you know, right.
Do you know, she's one of my favorites. I'm actually writing more on Harry Potter at the moment. I'm going to try and write another book.
Yay!
And and one of the things I'm doing sort of, I got to call it, you can give me your advice on this, but calling it something like Puzzling Harry Potter. So I would like to call it Harry Potter's Riddles, but I can't because someone's written that book.
There is another one.
There's
already
one.
That book, right.
Yeah. So, but the idea is sort of all the different ways in which language has double meanings. So all these kind of things like riddles, cryptic names, and one of them is floriography. So the use of flower symbolism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Lavender.
We know she loves all that stuff.
You
right?
know she loves all that. And it's massive in all of them. And I was giving a talk about it in the Ashmolean once. And someone said, what about Lavender? And I thought, well, I'd never thought about Lavender. And it means mistrust. Isn't that perfect?
Ooh,
she's the world's most mistrustful girlfriend with every right. I thought that's a perfect name for her.
Oh.
Cool stuff. But there we go. That's a happy ending. Lavender does not die. And a bit of girl support.
Right.
Nice. I like that.
We can all go on now. We can all go on with our days.
All right. Well, I know everyone has things that they have to rush off to, but thank you so much. And
thanks. It's really nice because I just sort of feel a sort of weird thing, isn't there, after a film? There's so much like before it comes out.
Yeah.
And then always feels like a slight sort of dead silence. And I feel like so much of the response to this film has just been people going, I don't like her, or I would like Depp, or whatever, and just
right.
Yeah.
And you know,
like, this is nothing to do with it.
I do think, like, and my first reaction was, I was like, I don't this. Like I said, this kind of, I don't know where we are. A lot of the relationship stuff doesn't make sense to me. I think that they felt they had made mistakes with some of the plot of the previous movie that they were just kind of glossing over, you know, with very quick resolutions.
Yeah, it doesn't always build.
Like, where's Leda? Theseus doesn't seem like he's exactly grieving in this movie. And there were a lot of things that emotionally I did not get them.
And you can see why, because they're just sort of thinking, well, we don't, you know, watching someone mourn is not that much fun. And we weren't actually that invasive. You know what I mean? You know,
and it takes time.
Exactly. And that's all very well if you're really invested in the relationship. But if these are not yet characters you really care about, you can see why they did it. But I agree with you, sort of think, wait a moment. You two were meant to be.
And I
forgot she died. I was like, oh, yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, the brother is supposed to be wrecked by that, but like, he didn't know her either. And so there was a lot of emotional, like the emotional connections of story that I like to have that were not there. And so that was coloring a lot of my disappointment. But actually our conversation here, if you approach it in an intellectual way, you know what I mean?
And I think also you've got to, that's right. And you just got to, I think you have got to just take it as it is, you know? So there's, there's obviously loads of problems and holes and things, but actually I thought what it did perfectly well, you know, it was fun. There were some good filmic set pieces. And there was a lot, you know, there are these things that we've been discussing that do have thought and time under them. They're just not always the bits people are looking at or whatever. But it's there's definitely things going into it, or just it depends how you want to look at
about
it,
definitely.
So I mean, decoding. I saw these reviews, I don't know if either of you seen Sonic 2, but there are lots of reviews sort of saying Sonic 2 is much better. I just thought, I don't even know what you're on, you know. Sonic 2 is just a silly movie. There's nothing wrong with it, but it's like there's nothing going on in Sonic 2 at all. And the fact, you know, this one definitely has depth, and it has all this, you know, linked to all this huge past thing, and it's more that people go in expecting something more.
I think that's a lot too,
you know. There's a lot of high expectations, but you just sort of think, well, when I saw that, I just thought, well, honestly, I just, this is all just ridiculous, because this is actually doing something.
Well, and I don't think you're able to see that, B.
And not everybody. You're the target audience. You know, and I think the film doesn't. I think it's really trying to answer those expectations with these moments of bringing in, you know, a very Potter theme, musical theme, you know, in these moments, and like really trying to capture, or the shots of Hogwarts, you know, and the swell of the theme, you know, it's very playing on the sentiments and the emotions and the attachment that people have to the IP, you
fan
know.
Fan service.
Yeah. Right, fan service. But then it's really delivering something that's rather different in a lot of ways, you know.
Yes.
So, I mean, it's always...
there's a certain amount of cake and eating it going on.
Yes, exactly.
So do we think that there are going to be more? They did end it on a sort of note of resolution.
They did. I mean, I think it's simply financial. I don't think anything else is going on, you know, so it's simply...
I think they don't know.
They don't know exactly. Does it get enough back? Because it's not just how much the movie takes. So the movie seems to me have taken a perfectly adequate amount, it's one of the things where, you know, the American, it's not taking very much in America, and American response is always like really based on the fact, oh, it's only made £100,000 in America, £100 million, sorry, in America. But you're like, well, it doesn't really matter, as long, you know, money's still money wherever it is. If it makes if it makes a lot more in the rest of the world, that's fine. But the American response is always like, I don't care about the rest of the world. It's really weird. It's like, I think Warner Brother doesn't care, as long as it's money, they don't care. But I suppose there's all this question of, then does it increase Harry Potter sales? Does people remind people about Harry Potter? Does it increase how much franchise stuff are they selling? You know, how many Lego sets being, all that kind of stuff, which we just don't really know
nifflers.
What's going. Exactly. We don't know how many plush nifflers are going. so that's the thing, isn't it? So, I mean, it cost $200 million to make. So it's not, it looks to me like it's not going to make much more back. It's not going to lose money, but it's going to be much more than that back. But that's just ticket sales. So it's just, what else is it doing? Is it worthwhile?
Right.
I really can't stand the way they're dressing Dumbledore, though. It's so
boring.
Did
you see that there was a brilliant tweet ages ago when the first one came out with him in his little three-piece suit? And it was like, how did we go from this to the purple thing? And someone tweeted that with the words, pre-tenure, post-tenure. I love that.
Something like that. But I need that. I need some explanation.
50 years of
diegetically explain to me why this guy, who we know is a flamboyant dresser, is dressing so boring.
I mean, that's because he hasn't had his tenure proven yet. So.
Somebody needs to say that in the film, not just on Twitter.
I think they think he's dressing sharp.
He's dressing
drab. Early 1930.
I don't think anybody.
It is drab.
There's no way, because he was going to see Tom Riddle in the orphanage.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. No, that's the problem, isn't it? Like, suit, like that's a really tough 5 years. Have you seen the one?
Yeah.
Like, next to you, like, ooh, what happened to you, Tom?
But what happens? And there better be an outing. Funny. There better be a he better comes out of his clothes closet, you know, in something fabulous.
Again, in the books, do you remember he's in purple flares. Velvet flares.
High-heeled boots.
So a bit wild. But I just mean, I think he's a bit younger looking in the books. I don't think when he visits Riddle, he could be a lot more age-wise.
Well, I'd have to do the math.
Maybe he needs to be. Maybe he needed to be free from the blood troth.
Well,
maybe that his
that is
flag.
That is the main reason.
Though. It shouldn't age him. It should be the opposite.
That is the main reason I want more films. Seriously. That is the main reason, because I need this resolved. You know me in clothing. I have to. The clothing has to be in place.
I certainly would like more films, and it would be a shame if, because I feel like the fans themselves are trying to destroy it. It's in the sort of odd.
Well, thing. I'm interested, and I'll watch any of it. Like I'm there for all of those.
More
things.
The merrier. Yeah. And you know, I do. I always enjoy a new thing to do some detective work on.
Oh, sure.
But it wouldn't be impossible. I think her role may go down and down. Mm-hmm. Clearly, quite a lot of this was Steve Kloves. We'll have to see. But they clearly ended. I think they ended it quite cleverly in the sense that it works as not an ending and it works as an ending. So they're sort of they're keeping their options open.
Yeah,
but Newt would do it again if he asked.
That's right. No, exactly. There's lots of open. It'd be fun to see Jacob and Queenie married.
Tina, it would be nice.
Tina,
to see
exactly.
Tina
and definitely
again.
With Tina,
well,
exactly.
And,
Tina,
Nagini?
It does feel like they're waiting for the next movie, doesn't it? That was part of this was right. Jacob and Queenie's one, and then they were going to have Tina and Newt getting together in the next. So I think that was a plan.
And we've got to see what happens with Nagini as well. I mean,
Nagini. That was another one of those things. I was like,
another one of those. Apparently, she's pregnant again. So there was again a possibility that maybe she was, you know, real life things kept her out.
Right.
Because it was such, talking about the actor, not the snake.
Yes, not the snake. No, the actor. So there's just one of those things where, because of COVID, things like that, which might not have been a problem. You know, that everything was much tighter scheduled and had to happen in short times and. Obviously more dangerous, you know, tight if it was at the beginning, pregnant woman say, like, I'm not gonna travel.
Yeah, and I guess the actress who plays Tina did have COVID at some point.
She did have COVID, and I think, you know, she looks a bit pasty to me. I thought she probably had it pretty bad. Yeah, exactly. So I think that was reason enough. And again, with just when you don't know how long she's gonna be ill. When someone's got long COVID, you don't know when it's going to stop. And so you're just like, simpler. But I do think it makes sense that there's just not quite space for that romance. Obviously, they could have a bit more, but there wasn't really space for the romance in the film, was there? Just time-wise.
Can I ask the question that I asked the others?
Is it about the clothing choice for Dumbledore?
No. No, I'll give that a break.
Why so drab, Dumbledore? Okay.
I'll give that a break. No, it's the question.
Like a true cosplayer.
Exactly. I'm noticing the threads. It's the question about, given what we know about, what we find out about Dumbledore and his orchestrations against Grindelwald, and what they mean for the future, who really saved the world? Was it Harry Potter? In the Harry Potter series, or was it ultimately Dumbledore?
You mean like in the way that he creates this elaborate plan because he's able to kind of understand how people will act and carry it out in ways that they don't even know about themselves.
Right. He's the mastermind.
Yeah. He set it up even after his death to play out in that way.
Right.
Yeah.
So
I think
does this take away from our understanding of Harry as this savior figure in the series, or does this, what do you think?
I don't think so, because Harry still had to make the choice, you know, the Horcruxes, not Hallows choice. And Dumbledore had no way of controlling that. There's also the whole business about the Older One winding up being Draco's instead of Snape's and all that type of stuff. I mean, Dumbledore had a plan, but it did not go entirely. There was the flaw in the plan. And so I think it depends on Harry, particularly, you know, deciding he was going to you know, trust Dumbledore and figure out what he wanted, even though it had not been entirely laid out in perfect clarity for him. And so I think that is very important. So no, I don't think it, I think Dumbledore as the mastermind wouldn't have done any good if Harry had just said, you know, forget this, I'm packing up and
right,
apparating to Brazil.
And I've got my own agenda.
And forget this. I'm not doing any of this. You know, I'm through risking my life for all these people. So yeah.
What about you, Emma?
I would say the answer to that is, does a band come down to its guitarist or its drummer? Like, this is about the whole collective, right? Mm-hmm.
You know, hey, Hermione's, some bands do. Like, yeah. Look at Rush. I don't know. Maybe that's a bad example.
Yeah. Neil Peart. But I think it's a family thing. It's a collective. It's a team effort. Even when Harry's like determined to run off on his own to like find Horcruxes, Hermione's like, don't be stupid. You know, how are you going to get by without me and Ron? When they go back to Hogwarts before the battle, it's like, Harry, tell them you're looking, you know, for something to do with Ravenclaw. You can't do this on your own. You know, Dumbledore might have been the brains or the planner behind it, but he needed everybody else involved. Harry needed his friends. He even needs his loved ones when he gets the Resurrection Stone. So, you know, he wouldn't have done it without Dobby. You know, and then we see the same thing in Fantastic Beasts. Like, Dumbledore's planning it, yeah, but that plan would not have worked without everybody involved.
Yeah, and they have to really be themselves. They have to do the things that are, as you were saying, Emma, that are authentic to them. And Dumbledore's counting on people being reliable in that way as a way to carry things out. And I think like that, I was thinking about like Newt is kind of the Harry character, but he's not really in control in the same way. And I think Harry actually has even a little bit more control than what we see Newt having. So far, anyway.
Go ahead.
None of those plans would have worked without the team.
Yeah, that's right. Right, including Teddy and Pickett.
Such wild cards.
Love that.
But also predictable in a sense, you know, especially Teddy. You know, Teddy is very predictable in that sense. He's always going to go for the gold. Always.
If you didn't see that coming, you weren't paying that much attention to the other films. I'm sorry. Right. He was never going for Pickett, ever.
Why? Yeah. Why would Dumbledore give Theseus a tie with a golden phoenix on it?
I got it for Christmas.
I do love that.
I know. I love that line.
So, but like with the Hogwarts, why did they go to Hogwarts? I mean, was it just a little nostalgia? Was that a little fan service?
Oh, it's so that they could have that theme. Come on, you know, just make us all, give us all goosebumps. Totally. Yeah.
I wish there was more of that, though, to justify it. And then we're off to Bhutan.
Well, and
I'm
sure
it's a lovely place, but I didn't totally get that.
Got McGonagall, who's just like a, you know, delivery service now or a message service now. It's like, ugh, really? Sorry.
Not like that.
I wasn't a fan. I was like, she's not even here.
You know, I had a little trouble with, now I think the casting of Aberforth was actually very good. I liked that actor in that role. I thought he conveyed a lot of the, you know, qualities of the character well. I don't know. You guys can tell, say if you didn't, but his eye is not blue. I had a little problem with that because of the, you know, the relationship with Deathly Hallows and the mirror, and Harry would never have mistaken Aberforth for Albus in the mirror.
Right. People's eye color doesn't change your eye color.
Yeah. You just have to pretend that didn't exist.
It's like Daniel Radcliffe's eyes were, you know, brilliant green the entire time. And, you know, so were Lily Potter's in all the flashback scenes as a kid, you know, semantics.
Yeah. They were like, we've already busted open the eye thing. So let's just cast who we want to cast, you know, regardless of his eyes.
Yeah, right. Jim Broadbent looks nothing like what Slughorn's supposed to
look like.
No, that's
true.
In the books, but he's particularly that scene where he gives Harry the memory is just so touching and masterful. It's like,
which of course also didn't happen in the book.
Chops.
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah, really good.
Yeah, I agree. It's okay for them to make some changes, I guess.
I mean,
I understand, you know, that has to happen.
I still would have wanted the book of this. instead of just the film, but you know.
I do feel like there's unexplored territory here. There's stuff going on. Like, I don't understand the stuff with Credence really very well. I felt like, why does he want to come home? Like, why is he writing these messages on the mirror?
He's Grindelwald's manipulative to almost the point of abusiveness. That's quite clear. That's his MO.
Yeah, but like, how does he discover he can write on the mirror? And does he know that it's Aberforth who's reading it? You know?
He's just casting out into the void, I guess. I don't know. No,
and I thought that they set up some stuff in the second movie that they regretted. Like Queenie going over and all the complex stuff with Leta and the, you know, the missing baby and all of that. And so they just felt like they had to tidy that up a little bit so they could get rid of some of it. And I was hoping for more from the Queenie story. I was really glad that they, you know, that they brought them back together and that they got married. Happy ending. Love that. But like, what the heck, Queenie? What the heck? Why did she go over there? She knew he was a bad dude. I wasn't totally satisfied.
Well, and I think she was mostly motivated by her love for Jacob and how that it's not okay, you know, in the current society for that love to be acted upon. But then she realized in going, and so she was drawn to Grindelwald's message about wizards, you know, being dominant over muggles so that this couldn't, you know, so that they could be open about their magic. But then I think when she got into the thick of it, she realized that this was also going to preclude, you know, the anti-muggle sentiment was also going to preclude her being with Jacob, and that this wasn't the answer either. I don't know. That's just my armchair analysis.
That's how they suck you in. You suck a Dumbledore in. Like, you know, Queenie was an easy target because she was in love and she was hurting. And that's, you know, that's how she got, you know, taken in. And then she got there and realized she was in a horrible toxic situation. But it's like, how do you leave someone who you're desperately afraid of? You know, that's the age old question of being manipulated and abused is, you know, it's not so easy to leave sometimes.
I was hoping she'd be like a double agent. I had this whole, my own little private story about Queenie being a mole and Grindelwald's
Queenie was your Snape.
Yes, but better. Snape.
Well, one thing that did strike me on this movie that was a bit disturbing, and of course it was disturbing in other movies. It's this whole, you know, you talk about this forbidden love and the oppressive government that, I mean, the whole criminal justice system in wizarding society that we have seen is just appalling. I mean. Emma, I know you've written pretty extensively about Azkaban and what a horrible, torturous violation of the Geneva Convention place that is. But I mean, compared to the American wizarding prison system, where you can, you know, have one person sentence someone to death and they take them off to that pool
that manipulates you into wanting to die.
I mean, that's horrible. And then you saw this German. It was in Germany, right? The prison there.
I think so.
Where you have these people in these little cubby holes waiting to get eaten by this monster that sends its tentacles up and grabs you. I mean, it reminded me of Stranger Things, you know, this just to be there for years and years on end and not knowing when you're going to be eaten. And the fact that, you know, Newt and Theseus had to get stuck there, get themselves out, leave all these other poor people behind. You know, Harry would have freed everybody else in the prison and at the same time and, you know, led them all to freedom. But
those things are still in place. Like
they just like off. Yeah. And, you know, it is, I don't know if it's part of this biggest thing, you know, how can this type of charismatic dictator arise that and gather this following? That maybe if your governmental systems and your criminal justice systems are set up to be this horrible oppressive thing anyway, I don't know, that really, really disturbed me. And I think the wizarding community as a whole needs to go take a few criminal justice classes at a Muggle university or something and figure out figure out a better way.
We need to get Arthur Weasley on this, you know.
You talked about, people talked about in Harry Potter, you know, the fact that the minister can just throw anyone he wants in Azkaban without trial. But it's like, you know, you compare it to what's going on in Germany and the United States, and it's actually it's actually probably the least horrible of the three, which is it's pretty disturbing.
Culture of cruelty almost.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's like this underlying sort of bent towards punishment. And then you can see how anti-Muggle sentiment sort of rises to the surface. They're just allowed to sit there, you know, Malfoy's, you know, outwardly anti-Muggle. No one cares, you know, as long as they keep greasing Fudge's palms, you know, he doesn't care. Just let him go. Like,
yeah, it's kind of emblematic of a larger corruption within the society.
And a callousness, and I guess almost an indifference towards cruel and unusual punishments.
So I sense there's a paper in here. Somebody could write a paper about the various prisons across the wizarding world.
Oh, definitely.
Because I know people have done a lot with Azkaban, you know, and within the Harry Potter series, the Law and Justice. But I think they're, you know, bring in the Fantastic Beasts stuff, like you're saying, Louise. Now we've got this German one, and we've got the one at the Lake of Death in the United States. Like, all together, these are, yeah, they're objectively cruel and corrupt and authoritarian. And when will wizards say enough is enough? Prison reform.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was wonderful.
I told you you like my closing quote. I felt inspired by that one. I don't usually do narrative as the closing quote. I usually pick something that a character has said. But I saw that one and I thought, I think that's really what we're talking about, right? Priori incantatum and the Phoenix song.
Dumbledore is so God. He's so God in these books, and Harry is so Jesus. So yeah, I mean, I think it's a tag team effort, you know, in terms of the answer to the question of who saved the world.
That's such a good question, though. Film
really made me think about that. Mm-hmm. You know, so
that's actually what I liked, was the, you know, seeing, like, we're seeing another example of how Dumbledore works with people. Like, this is like human resources training. Because he understands people, and he has a sense for, you know, what they'll do in the circumstances, you know, that they're given. And
why does he dress so shitty? Oh. I'm so done with it. Like, why? Where's the purple cloaks? Where's the high heeled boots? Where's it? Like, there better be some explanation in the last film for why he decides to bring out the Albus.
You can have him played by Johnny Depp in the last film, and Johnny Depp will bring the purple robe.
Wow. You know, it's just done. I mean, it's making gay people mad. You know what I mean?
Doesn't he look pretty stylish, though? It's like 1930s style.
Drab. It's not. It's drab. And it's like the way it's conspicuous, the way he dresses in the books. It's conspicuous how he wears purple and high heeled boots and, you know, fabulous spangled hats and things like that. I mean, it's just, it's conspicuous, and it's like, it's not.
I think they wanted to make him look as sad as possible in this particular movie.
He's emo Albus.
That's right. It was it was melancholy, and it was all Albus and his, you know, his secrets.
Yeah.
His problem past.
Well, I've talked to some people who are like, this is just another case of a failure to represent. Hmm. But which is why I'm hoping that there's some answer for it. Like, there's no flamboyance. There's no flamboyance.
Well, you know, in the historical context, I don't know how much flamboyance there might have been. I mean, thinking about that makes me think about Oscar Wilde, who might have had certain kinds of flamboyance for his time and era, but it certainly wasn't anything you could see physically if you just looked at him. I don't know.
Hmm.
I'm not sure that making that argument about Dumbledore doesn't seem like a retcon to me. Doesn't seem like trying to read Dumbledore from a modern perspective rather than from a 1920s or 30s perspective. I don't know.
Well, doesn't he wear something pretty flamboyant, like when we see those memories of him going back and meeting Tom Riddle? Or was that just the movie?
No, definitely it's, well, it's definitely in the books because Harry's like, nice outfit, sir.
Oh.
You know, and Dumbledore's
like. And that's like, is that the 50s?
40s.
40s.
So mm-hmm. I'm not sure that we can make, you know, the historical argument. I mean, wizards already dress weird. And they're not doing that either.
Maybe he's freer now that he doesn't have this, you know, blood troth with Grindelwald.
And yeah.
He'll bring a little.
He'll whip out some Lando Calrissian capes. This is what I really want.
About the film series continuing is whether we might see young Tom Riddle again. I mean, once we get to 1945, that is the year that the Chamber of Secrets was opened. Because it was 50 years before, obviously, Harry's second year. So no, it would have been 1942 when the Chamber of Secrets was opened,
mm-hmm.
because it's 1992 in the second Harry Potter book. So, because we tend to see, you know, Hogwarts shows up at some point in every film, it makes me wonder when it shows up in maybe the fourth film, will Tom Riddle be a student there at that point? I don't know.
Creepy.
I love the teacher. Loved
Lally.
Oh yeah, she was great.
Yeah, it's funny. No matter how dark a society gets, you've got these good teachers. You've got Dumbledore. You've got Lally, and you've got that.
Yeah, whole and I love how her message is like, take charms. You need to take this class.
Yeah,
that's how.
And
I
isn't
am.
That good for a teacher? You know, you need to use a lot of charm in the classroom, I think, to get your message across.
Yeah, I love her book too. The magic book. What's not to like? I mean, this is like a character that's exactly directed toward me. What character should we put in this movie for Katie?
A charming teacher with a book.
A magic book that transports you.
Yeah, love it.
Couldn't be better.
Yeah.
Okay, so I have a question. One of the things that B had talked about at the end of the episode was that she was interpreting that last scene between Dumbledore and Grindelwald as, you know, the duel that they have. And Grindelwald kind of takes himself off, right? And in the bubble falls over the cliff or whatever. And he doesn't take out Dumbledore. And she read that as a sign that Gellert still loves Albus, you know, that there's still a lot of feeling there. Do you guys think that's true? I feel like Dumbledore still has some feelings, but he's clear-eyed about, you know, Grindelwald being evil. But what do we think about Grindelwald?
Yeah, I think I agree with B in the sense that I'm just thinking about it pragmatically. Like if they do pursue the last two films in this series, I think that conflict has to remain for it to be, you know, believable in terms of the conflict that Dumbledore feels in fighting against this person and the conflict that Grindelwald feels, and to humanize both of those characters. I think they have to keep that flame going somehow, even now that that blood troth is broken.
I'm not sure how much Grindelwald loves Dumbledore, because how much does a person like that who's manipulative truly, like, even when they believe that they love you, how much they actually, you know, love you in a pure sense. But he's obviously still got a soft spot for him, because even towards the end he's like trying to misdirect Voldemort from, you know, getting the Old Wand and breaking into Dumbledore's tomb. So there's got to be something there. But I think Albus is always going to have a soft spot, and that even carries through to the scene in King's Cross Station, you know, when he starts sort of getting upset about the whole thing, because if he didn't care, it wouldn't upset him. He wouldn't feel the need to hide it from Harry. It wouldn't bring tears to his eyes when he talks about it in the afterlife.
Well, and there's also the when Dumbledore says, well, you know, I heard he expressed some remorse in his later years, you know, so it sounds like Dumbledore, you know, basically from 1945 up until, you know, the Battle of or to the end of his life, he sounds like he had almost no contact, only heard very indirectly about what was even going on. So I did think that was interesting, you know, in a nice parallel with you know, Harry's, you know, try for some remorse, Tom, at the end.
I was just thinking that too, Louise.
I was interesting to say, you know, I hoped he had some regret, because that's his only salvation.
Yeah, and I was thinking, when you think about Grindelwald versus Voldemort in terms of, you know, analyzing them as villains, mm-hmm. I think Grindelwald, there's a little more complexity to him maybe than Voldemort, who just seems like he's evil from the time he's a kid, you know? And so I don't, I'm interested in the idea, right? And Voldemort is incapable of remorse, but somehow Grindelwald is capable of it, but maybe it's just the longevity of his life. I don't know.
You know, and incapable of love. I mean, Voldemort, you know,
right.
Didn't, I mean, Grindelwald, for all his faults, you know, he does seem to have had love and friendships, at least as a young man, before mm-hmm. he got sucked into this ideology of his.
Every time I start to feel sympathy for Grindelwald, though, I think about him just slitting the throat of the Chilling. Nope.
Oh, I know.
That was awful. That's the worst moment in the whole movie. In all three of the movies.
I know. Yeah. And that I was like, aren't these beasts cute? Ah, you know, it's just this horrible moment where, I mean, I think that's my problem with this entire series, is that it's like, which one is it? Is it cute magical animals or is it child abuse and animal cruelty and just the worst possible, you know, kind of prejudice and racism? Like, it feels like a weird setting for all these, a weird display case for all these adorable magical creatures who, like, my 10-year-old is really interested in, but I can't let him watch the movies for these very reasons.
Well, let's just be thankful they didn't put all Voldemort stuff in the movies, you know, murdering his entire family and turning him into Horcruxes and ripping his soul repeatedly and all sorts of stuff. So,
yeah. Again, a reason Fantastic Beasts should be books, I think.
So it can be more gruesome.
Books for adults.
And that brings us to the end of our episode, where we are dishing all about the latest Fantastic Beasts movie, Secrets of Dumbledore. No holds barred. You got our opinions, our questions, our quandaries, and the things we liked best. Thanks to all my guests, including my co-host Emily Strand, and also Beatrice Groves, Lana Whited, Louise Freeman, and Emma Nicholson. It's always great to talk with your friends about the things that are dear to your heart. And so now we are going to end this episode with a quote from Newt Scamander from Secrets of Dumbledore, who said, "Even if we make mistakes, terrible things, we can try to make things right. And that's what matters, trying."
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes. And be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsburn, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand. And produced by Sean Elsbond. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.